Okay, so let me just like maybe give a high-level review of what we've done so far. So we've been studying conformal symmetry, and then the first part we discussed conformal symmetry as a from the point of view of just pure geometry, and we classified what the conformal symmetries in flat space are. And then in the last lecture, what I did two things. So one is that when you're in field theory or in quantum mechanics or whatever, and you have a symmetry, you have to learn how to represent the symmetry on your operators and on the Hilbert space. So in the last lecture, what I told you is how a conformal symmetry, which generated, these are the generators of the conformal algebra, act on the operators in the theory. They have to furnish representation. I mean, if you have a symmetry acting on your physical system, the physical system should be in a representation of that symmetry. In particular, operators should be in representations of the conformal algebra. And we discussed that operators can either be primary operators, which transform just purely as tensors, and are labeled by the quantum, by the spin and the scaling dimension, or they can be descendants, which are just derivatives of primary operators, and therefore, if we know the correlator of a primary, we know the correlator of a descendant just by taking a derivative. Okay, so then using a counting argument, I showed you that the 2 and 3 point functions, the position dependence of the 2 and 3 point functions are completely fixed. And this is very much unlike in usual quantum field theory, where you can have arbitrary functional dependence of the different, the separation between points, okay? While in a conformal field theory, the extra constraints here completely fix the position dependence. It's important to notice that if you had a theory that is a scale invariant but not conformal invariant, for example, didn't have this, the 3 point function would not be completely fixed. You can try to convince yourself of that fact. Okay, so the fact that it's completely fixed really uses the full conformal symmetry, not just dilatations. Okay. So here I just wrote down what the answer is for scalar primary operators. This can be easily generalized to operators that have spin. So imagine you have a vector, like a current. A current is a vector in space-time. So you could imagine what is the two-point function of the current, or actually, more importantly, what is the two-point function, say, of the energy-momentum tensor? Okay, that is a symmetric tensor. And then the statement still holds true, but now, of course, whatever you write here on the right-hand side has to transform the same way as the left-hand side. So if you have something that's a tensor here, the right-hand side has to be a tensor. And as I explained in the notes, essentially, the tensorial structure that can appear here when you have an operator that's not a scalar essentially can be built from an important tensor, which essentially is the Jacobian. So it's a special tensor that has amazing good properties under scale transformation, which essentially is, so it's some matrix I mu nu. It is something like x squared delta mu nu minus 2x mu x nu x squared. This is essentially just the Jacobian of inversion. And then using this tensor, you can construct the metric, if you wish, the tensor that you would need to construct, let's say, the two point function of a current or of a vector. Okay. Now, how did we find this? The way we found this is by saying that if you have a symmetry, for the 3 point function, what you would say is that you have, I'm not going to write all the indices, O1, OI, OJ, OK. Okay, you have a 3 point function. The statement that the theory has conformal symmetry is the statement that the variation of this correlation function vanishes. That's what it means that something is a symmetry. The transformation leaves that object invariant, right? So what you did in the exercises is to essentially solve this equation. And this equation is nothing but the sum of 3 terms, delta OI, OJ, OK, plus OI, delta OJ, OK, plus OI, OJ, delta OK equals 0. Okay? And the solution of this equation uniquely gives you this. Okay, so this is the functional form. For the two-point function, we can there's a choice of normalization, so the two-point function is just one. Okay. And the only non-trivial thing that appears in two-point function is delta I, okay, which are the scaling dimensions of the primaries. These are the things that in statistical mechanics are related to the critical exponents in the phase transition. Now, in the three-point function, again, the position dependence is fixed in terms of the dimensions, but now you have a non-trivial coefficient here that it's not fixed by the symmetry, and, it's fixed by dynamics. Okay, and actually, the information of the CFT also depends on that. Okay, so from the two and three prime function, we discovered that there are unknowns. So symmetry, I mean, usually in physics, symmetry allows you to parameterize the form of the answer. But then there are some unknown functions that you have to determine in a specific problem. It's like when you do scattering in quantum mechanics around a spherically symmetric potential. You know, you can do a partial wave expansion. There are partial wave amplitudes, but the coefficient of the partial wave amplitude is not determined by the symmetry. It's determined by the specific potential that you're looking at. So this is an analog of that. So we kind of constrained the correlators using the symmetry, but now we have to determine the data. This is not fixed by symmetry alone. Yes.
Here you're writing delta ij or ijk. Sorry.
This should have been ijk. Yeah. Is that what you mean?
No. It's like, does the coefficient c depend on the like the real nature of the scale operator? Like the operator j has to be the same as k.
No, no, it can be anything.
Only the mass dimension has to be the same.
So here, okay. So here, actually. So here, delta, in order for this to be non-zero, that's what I mean by this. The delta I has to equal delta j. Okay?
But
yes, you could have different operators that have the same dimension, and they can have a non-trivial two-point function. Here, there is no constraint. Delta I, delta j, and delta k can be anything. There is no selection rule.
One more question?
Yes.
In the last lecture, you mentioned at some point that if you have local invariants under special conformal transformations, then the local dilatations follow automatically.
Yes.
But the other direction was non-trivial, but also true, correct?
Yes.
Okay. But then, because you said earlier that...
it's true under some kind of mild assumptions.
Okay. Because you just said that if you only have dilatation, then the
frequency... Yeah, yeah. So this is a statement about kinematics. The statement I'm saying about the dilatation in place conformal invariant is a much deeper statement that involves using properties like unitarity.
Okay.
Yeah. But at the level, if you're a mathematician and you don't know about unitarity, you could have considered the possibility of having a theory that has D but not K. But locality and unitarity seems to force, and again, mild assumptions of locality, that if you have D, you have K. That roughly fits the intuition that K can be thought of as a local dilatation. So if the theory is invariant under D, it should be invariant under K, because K is just remember that I always split the conformal transformation into a local Lorentz rotation and a local dilatation. So if the system is invariant under D, it's not shocking that it's surprising. But this is a lie, because I can construct examples of theories that are not maybe physical in some way, that are invariant under D but are not invariant under K. So you could fool yourself into believing that this kind of quick argument has loopholes. But these loopholes are avoided if the theory has good properties like unitarity. Okay, so this is the data. Now, so now at this point you could say, okay, one other question would be, if I give you a collection of data, this data, would this be a consistent CFT or not? Okay. So one of the things that we will see today is that actually, if you randomly or ask a computer to spit out data for this data, you will find that this data is inconsistent. Okay. So this data, at this point, is arbitrary. I just told you there's some numbers, right? But now what we'll see today is that actually, this data satisfies the CFT data obeys strong nonlinear constraints. And actually, it's hard to find consistent sets of deltas and Cs that give rise to a consistent CFT. Okay? So, and this fits with the intuition that CFTs are rather sporadic things. Okay? Whenever you go to a CFT, like in a critical point, you have to tune something, right? You have to tune the temperature or the magnetic field or something like that, right? And this kind of fits with that intuition in the sense that CFTs are special, okay? And you cannot just construct arbitrary CFTs by tuking around with, you know, changing C by a small number or by adding a square root of 2 to one of the coefficients. That wouldn't be the case. Okay. And actually, the constraint that you get, if you wish, are a very fancy generalization, just to give you kind of intuition, of the Jacobi identity in the algebras. So, you know, in the algebra, you can write down commutators and you have Fijks, right? And you could say, okay, any Fijk will do. I mean, I can write anything I want. But we know that that's not true. I mean, Fijks have to satisfy the Jacobi identity, okay? So the analog of Fijk in the algebra is this data. And what we're going to discuss today is the analog of the Jacobi identity that this data has to satisfy. The data it will satisfy will be much, much, much more non-subtle, much more subtle than the data, than the Jacobi identity. But we will see. Okay. And this linear constraints are some consistency conditions that the theory has to obey. Okay. So now you could ask, where do these consistency conditions come from? So the natural question would be, okay, why did I stop at 3 points? I could have gone to 4 points. Will I not keep getting more and more data and then never get out of this mess? And the point is no. The point is that in a CFT, any endpoint function can be reduced. This still might be a non-trivial reduction, but conceptually can be reduced to 2 and 3 point functions. So if you wish, higher point functions do not include any further data beyond what we have here. But since there are different ways of computing the endpoint function, that data will satisfy certain constraints that we will spell out today. Okay, so now, actually, in a CFT, it suffices in order to determine what are the constraints. It's believed. That's not true in 2 dimensions, but in higher dimensions, it's believed that all the constraints that you ever have to worry about that the CFT data has to obey follow from looking at the 4-point function. So if you understand the constraints from the 4-point function, you're done. Okay. So now we're going to study the constraints on CFT data from 4-point function. Now, the first thing I'll be quick because I think you're professionals right now. So now we're going to have a 4-point function. So we're going to have 4 points, okay? And now we can ask the same thing. You can ask, can there be a non-trivial position dependence that's not determined by symmetry on the 4-point function? And how would you do that? How would you answer this question? You could try to generalize what we did here. This argument I showed you, right? I showed you that by using the conformal symmetry, I could map these 3 points arbitrarily to 3 fixed points. And therefore, there was no non-trivial space-time dependence left. Here we could do exactly the same thing. So imagine I start with 4 points, x1, x2, x3, x4. So I have 4 local operators instead of those points. I already showed you that by acting with k mu, p mu, and m 1 j, where j goes from 2 to d, and dilatations, that I could map, say, these 3 points, okay, 1, 2, and 4, I could map them to 0. Sorry, now let me do 1, 3, and 4. I could map it to this. Right? This is what I did last time. And now I have an extra point, x2 double prime, floating around. Now, but So let's continue. And now you could ask, okay, now can I use the remaining symmetries of the problem? Because I have not used all the symmetries of the conformal algebra. Can I use the conformal symmetries in such a way that I can remove some degrees of freedom from this point? Now, right now here there are d parameters, right? These are the d coordinates of the position of this point. But of course, I have to act on this in a way that I don't mess up the other 3 points, right? Now, what's left? Essentially, all that's left is Lorentz rotations, right? I have not used all possible Lorentz rotations that I could have used because I only use the one J ones, okay? So now what you can do is act with, so a Lorentz rotation fixes famously the origin and infinity, right? But I want to act with a Lorentz rotation that will also keep this fellow fixed, right? Because I don't want to, otherwise I would add parameters. So what I can do is I can do a Lorentz rotation in the transverse directions to this x1 axis. Okay. So in particular, what I can do is a Lorentz rotation along the 2j axis, where j goes from 3 to d to bring x2 prime. So essentially, by doing a rotation, so this rotation will keep this vector fixed. Is that clear? I mean, I'm not touching that axis. So it, since I have zero, yes.
How would you in two dimensions? If you don't have, if you cannot make a rotation.
So you want to do
it? Because here we're doing rotation for like the remaining one, but if I had zero.
Yeah, so if you were in two dimensions, you'd be done. And then how many parameters would you get? There you go. You get two. So now, but now let's do it. Let's compute it in d dimensions. How many parameters we get? And the point is that you always get two, because now do this. This keeps all these other three fellows fixed. But now I can use this to set the third blah 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 up to this coordinate to zero. So I can map this to the vector x y 0 0 1 0 0 infinity. So that means that, and now I'm done. I mean, there is no other Lorentz rotation that will allow me to eliminate more parameters here. Okay. So that means that the correlator depends on two parameters arbitrarily. This is to be contrasted with there, in which the correlator didn't depend on any parameters. Okay. So now this now will be a non-trivial function that is not determined by just conformal symmetry. Okay. Good. Let me see what I want to say. Okay. So maybe a question, so this is a bit more engaging. So can someone get? Okay. Yes. Before.
So in two dimensions, in particular, the dilations and special conformal transformations that we've studied, they're in particular part of the two-dimensional conformal.
Yes, it's a global conformal algebra. Yes.
Okay, but the conformal symmetry is bigger, right?
Yes, but those do funny things. I mean, other than the global algebra, the other ones have singularities somewhere in the complex plane.
Oh, okay.
There's a pole, yeah. So what I wanted to ask you, imagine now I look at a higher point function, okay? Just based from this kind of game, can someone guess for sufficiently high number of points how many parameters? So imagine I give you now an endpoint function. The question is, how many parameters can this depend on? Depend on. And for avoid degeneracies, let's say when n is sufficiently large. For example, let me give you an example. So in the thing that you asked, I was already done here, right? I had already used everyone that I had because I only have one Lorentz rotation M12. Now if I was in three dimensions, I would be done at this step because I have only 2, 3. But if I was in four dimensions, I would still have one guy that I did not use, right? I have M34, okay? So, but eventually I'm gonna run out of things that I can use, okay? So using kind of this logic, can someone guess what the answer of to this question is? So how many parameters do we have to start with? If I have n points, how many parameters do I have? N times d, okay? And what is the logic that we have been using? I have been using the conformal algebra to eliminate parameters, right? So how many parameters does the conformal algebra have? Sorry? No. What's the dimension of SO2, D? That's the conformal algebra, right? SO2, D. It's 1/2 d plus 2 times d minus 1, right? So. I mean, this guy is the dimension of SO2, D. So that's it. So what I'm telling you with all of this is that there is a very simple way for you to figure out the number of parameters or cross, okay, I'll come back to that now. The number of parameters that an endpoint function in a CFT can depend on. You just follow this game. At low end of n, you're gonna run out of things that you can use, and then this formula takes over. Okay, so this was just a quick and dirty way of telling you what parameters can the four-point function or actually endpoint function depend on. What is a more invariant way of parameterizing the parameters? So another way of saying this is that when you are at 4 points and beyond, it is possible to construct quantities that are completely conformal invariant, which are left invariant by the full conformal symmetry. Okay, and if they're left invariant, you can add an arbitrary function of it on the right hand side because acting on it kills it, leaves it invariant. Okay, so in a more covariant way, what we're doing is noticing that when you have four points and higher, there exists conformal invariant cross ratios. So these are coordinates that are invariant of the full conformal algebra. So for the 4 point, there are two cross ratios. We call them U, X12 square, X34 square. Remember that these are distances between points, X13 square, X24 square, and then V. And I go from here to here by replacing the point 1 and 3. Okay? I have X14 square, X23 square, X13 square, X24 square. So I have two cross ratios, the function u and v. These are the same, they contain the same information as the two parameters x and y, okay? It's in a more invariant way. And now one thing you can easily check is the following, okay? Now this quantity is obviously invariant under what? It's obviously invariant under translations, rotations, and dilatations, right? Because you have as many x's upstairs and downstairs. What's not so obvious is that it's invariant under special conformal transformations, but one thing you can check, well, you can check that explicitly, but one way you can convince yourself is that under an inversion, which is closely related to special conformal transformations, where x tilde went to x over x squared, right? You know that you can show that 1 over x tilde square ij is xi square xj square divided by xij square, okay? Under an inversion. So, but if you put this back in here, it's left invariant, okay? Good. So, so this means now the following. So now let's look. So now I'm gonna do the analog that I did here for the 4-point function, okay? But for simplicity, I'm going to look at the 4-point function of identical scalar operators. And I'm going to call it, for some reason, phi. OK? So we're looking at the phi x1, phi x2, phi x3, phi x4. Now we're going to write down what is the most general form that conformal symmetry allows us to have here. OK? So first of all, from what I discussed, what can I put here? So the left-hand side is invariant under conformal transformation. So I can write now here anything that I can construct out of the data from the left-hand side that's conformal invariant. So what I can do, I can write an arbitrary function g of the cross ratios u and v. This is allowed because it's conformal invariant. Okay, there is no constraint whatsoever. I can always add this. This is the analog in the usual Poincaré case where you have a you can have an arbitrary function of x1 minus x2. You know, Poincaré symmetry does not tell you what the function is. It can be any function. So in the conformal world, the analog of that statement is that you have can have an arbitrary function of the cross ratios u and b. And of course, now the dimensions have to match. So you can parameterize this in such a way that you have x1, 2 times 2 delta phi, x3, 4 to the 2 delta phi. Where delta phi is the dimension of this operator, scalar operator. Good. And now we see that we are out of luck, if you wish, at this point we can no longer say anything more about this function. Okay, but soon I will tell you that in fact, I'll tell you several things. I'll tell you that GUV, which a priori we don't know anything about, is not an independent function. It's fixed in terms of the 2 and 3 point functions and conformal symmetry. GUB is completely determined by delta by the CFT data. Plus SO2, D, plus the conformal algebra. And in fact, we can use the fact, and we will show that the 4 point function constrains the CFT data delta I, C, I, J, K. OK, so now, but to do that, I will have to introduce some things here. Okay, so one thing I can say, which is kind of at this point will sound very trivial, is that I can use Bose symmetry. So these are four identical particles, I can replace them, right? So in particular, the correlator should be invariant under the replacement of point one and three. These are four identical particles, essentially, right? So what does this imply? This implies the following relation. That, and I already said that under, OK, did I say that? Yeah, that under replacing the coordinate 1 and 3, B and U are exchanged. You can see this from here, right? If I replace 1 and 3 here, I get B and U exchanged. So that this implies that the thing I had on the left, OK, let me write it here. So Bose symmetry implies that this should be the same as u replaced by b and vice versa. And I have to map 1 and 3. So this will be 2, 3 to the 2 delta phi, x1, 4 to the 2 delta phi. Right? Yes.
In the tutorial, we found those sort of type of denominators by studying the scaling properties.
Yes.
Those denominators come from that?
Yes, of course, yes. Okay. So here, what is the total scaling dimension on the left-hand side? It's four delta phi, right? That's exactly how the denominator here scales, 4 delta phi.
Oh.
Yeah. So now what I can do is I can bring this guy to this side and this guy to this side. They will combine nicely into cross ratios. And from here, we will get an equation that we will exploit. Right now, it seems trivial, but we will exploit it very heavily very soon. And we'll have non-trivial consequences. So from here, we can write the equation that V delta phi G UV equals U delta phi G V U. OK? All I did is equate this equation and use the formula for the cross ratios. Okay. Good. So now, in order to show you these claims, I have to introduce a very important notion in quantum field theory and in conformal field theory in particular, which is called the operator product expansion. And we use the acronym OPE, operator product expansion. In CFT. Okay. So what's the basic idea behind this the operator product expansion? Is essentially the following intuitive statement. It's very closely related to the idea of a Taylor series. Okay? The idea is that if I give you two operators that are close to each other, okay, there are two operators, let's say they're close to each other, and you look at them from very far away, you cannot really distinguish them from one from a local operator. Okay? So that means that from far away, any two operators can be represented by, in general, an infinite sum of local operators of one local operator. Okay. So let's make this more precise. So let's have operator OI here and operator OJ here, and I draw a sphere that surrounds both of them. It means that within this sphere, if I look from farther away from this sphere, I can represent this. I can expand this. So this guy is at point say x1. This guy is at point x2. I can represent this as an infinite a sum over all possible local operators, say inserted at x2. Let me write it as OK. I'm trying to OK x2 with an arbitrary function fijk. Okay. So this mimics also the idea of a multiple expansion. From far away, you can expand things in a multiple expansion. And in this world, what it means is that this OK will be, in principle, all primary operators of the CFT, but also all of the descendants, all the derivatives. This will be like the higher multiple moments. So the sum over K here is a sum over, implies sum over primaries. And descendants. Yes. Okay, that's a good. Yeah. So this is a local statement. This statement that I'm saying that. I have to qualify the statement. So this statement is: take any two. Take a 75-point function. If I have, I can pick any two operators, and if I'm able to draw a sphere around them that does not include anyone else, I can replace those two operators by the one on the right hand side. Another way of saying it is that this is a convergent expansion. Okay, the radius of convergence of OPE is to the nearest to the next operator. So imagine this is a big correlation function, okay? And I have another operator that's located here. O, I don't want to use K, okay, whatever. O L X 3. Replacing this guy by the OPE is converges as long as the way to say it is that essentially as long as this guy is, it converges up to the location of the next operator, okay? So you may worry that you can never do this, but that's not true. If I give you a collection of endpoints, I can always look at the two ones that are closest, do the OPE of that guy, and then continue that way. There might be an exercise in which you will be asked to prove this. In a free field theory, take a four-point function or whatever, or in a free field theory, and you can do the local OPE of two points. You will show that this gives you a power series in 1 over x1, 2. That series converges as long as x1, 2 is smaller than x2, 3. Okay? So this statement is a local statement. It's true inside any correlation function. There could be 75 other operators, but the only thing that matters is that the other operators are outside a ball that I can draw around these two points. Is that clear? You look confused, so maybe I'm not explaining myself well.
It's just, how do we find the OK?
So now we're going to determine OK. Well, OK is anything, right? So it's like in quantum mechanics. You know, you have a something, and you expand in all possible things you can expand. Now, the thing that's special about CFT is that the sum here over all intermediate states or intermediate operators, just a second, it splits very nicely into primaries and descendants. And furthermore, the thing that's really non-trivial is that this function fijk, which a priori could be an arbitrary mess function of x1 and x2, is completely fixed by conformal symmetry. That will be the point that I'm going to go to next. Yes.
So in our original model, we had two operators.
Yeah.
Just two operators.
Yes.
Okay. And then we're changing that into a sum over smaller bubbles with a
no
only up.
No, but this guy is still there. So what we've done in this exercise, I've gone from a three-point function to an infinite sum of two-point functions.
Okay.
So you reduce the rank. Is that the right word? You go from an n-point function to an n minus one-point function by doing the OPE of two local operators. So obviously, if you keep doing that, you can always reduce that to a two and three-point function. You just keep doing the OPE until you get to the two-point, and that's where we're going to go back to the statement that everything is them in terms of the two and the three-point function.
Will there be non-trivialities if the space-time doesn't allow you to? If the problem is that there's a hole in space-time, for example.
A hole? What do you mean by a hole?
I don't know. Between x1 and x2, you get some sort of obstruction of the structure of space. I mean, itself that doesn't like allow you to draw.
Well, so here I'm talking about, so this is a local statement. So this will be true in any space that is locally flat. Right?
Okay.
Now, if you have a singularity in space-time, we have to understand how you do quantum field theory in a singular space. We know how to do string theory in a singular space, but we don't really know how to do quantum field theory in a singular space. You have to define what boundary conditions you put at the singularity, blah, 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 blah. No, so this would be true if you were in two dimensions, on a genus 75 Riemann surface, this statement would be true locally. But as long as the space is smooth, this is a perfectly fine. If you have singularities, you have to tell me what the hell do you mean by a singularity and what boundary conditions you put there and blah, blah, blah. Yes? So in principle, you can do it in any quantum field theory. It's kind of an open point. This point that I was making here about the radius of convergence is a bit unclear, whether the OPE is convergent in a massive quantum field theory. I believe it is. But the main point is not really useful, is that, which is the thing I haven't yet shown, is that unlike in a conformal field theory where this guy is the position dependence is completely fixed, in a massive quantum field theory, it's not completely fixed. So it's kind of, you're playing with things that you don't know. There are undetermined things all over the place, so it's not that useful. Yeah. But of course, the notion exists in a massive quantum field theory. Yeah. So now let's put some formulas, some flesh into this. So in formulas, you can write this by saying that OI at x1, OJ at x2 can be replaced inside any correlation function as a sum of a tensor Fijk, which a priori is a function of the distance between 1 and 2. We're doing like a power series, like a Taylor series, right? So it's going to be a Taylor series in the distance between x1 and x2. I said that everyone contributes, the primaries and the descendants. So you can have an arbitrary number of derivatives acting on the operator that you're going to replace at the origin. So I write this in this way. By delta 2 means any derivative on the operator at point 2, OK? Sorry?
Just over primaries?
If you write it this way, it's sum over primaries, yes. So now the thing that's where conformal symmetry will come in. So I'm not going to go through, I think this is in the notes. What I want to say is that conformal symmetry essentially tells you that Fijk as a function of x and delta is completely fixed up to some. So there's a prefactor that's not fixed, and which we are going to determine in a minute. It's a very specific function of x. X of delta k minus delta I minus delta j. That's just fixed by a scaling symmetry. Okay, the scaling dimension on the left hand side is scaling weight is delta one delta I plus delta j, right? The scaling weight of this guy is delta k, so f has to rescale in this way, just by dimensional analysis essentially, by scaling analysis, and then this can take the form one plus alpha x mu d mu. So now I write down things that will have to have scaling weight zero and have to be Lorentz scalars. So I'm going to get the most general power series of this type. And now the point is that these coefficients alpha and beta are completely determined by conformal symmetry. Okay, so alpha, beta, and the whole series, alpha, beta, determined by conformal symmetry. So this can be proved in many ways, but maybe the most intuitive one is to do the OPE within the three-point function. And this will also tell us what the overall coefficient here that I didn't write down actually is. We will see that the coefficient in the OPE, can someone guess what it will be? It will be precisely the coefficient of the three-point function. This tensor here, Cijk, will be precisely, I probably erased it. Maybe not. Yeah, that's it. The Cijk that appears in the three-point function. Okay, and that starts looking with what I said, that the data that keeps appearing is deltas and Cijks. Okay, so now how do we find more specifically this function? One way you can do it is by taking the three-point function and doing the OPE between the first operator and the second operator, and then compare the full answer that we know from the three-point function with the OPE expansion. Yes?
We would depend on the three-point function if we can always reduce Eigenfield. Because I was saying we can always reduce two-point. We reduce, why is it?
Let me show you in a second, and yeah, you can ask me again, 1 second. So let's see, so I have OI x1, OJ x2, OK x3. Okay, so this we already know what it is, right? This was Cijk, let me not write it, x12 to some power, x13 to some power, x23 to some power, right? Now, let me you do the OPE of these two guys. All I do is just plug this thing here, right? What am I going to get? I'm going to get a sum over k prime of f I j k prime, which is a function of x12, the derivative over the point x2 of now I'll get a two-point function, right? I'll get okay. Okay prime at x2 times ok at x3. But we know what this is. What is this? This is nothing but delta kk prime or 1 over x 2, 3 to the 2 delta k, right? And now this function is acting here, right? I have a function. It's a function of x12. I have a derivative here that acts on the location of x2. If you wish, I can put the 2 here. And now I can determine this fijk by, so now you can do a series expansion on both sides. On both sides. And determine what f is. Another way of saying it is to determine all these numbers, alpha, beta, and the overall coefficient, okay? So what we do with a parallel series expansion in the series, a convergent series x12, x23. So the thing that's very clear from this argument is that this tells you what the normalization of fijk is. Let's look at the leading order term between the left and the right. It tells you that fijk is precisely cijk. So that tells you that the normalization of the OPE is exactly the three-point function. Okay, so this tells you in particular that fijk is proportional to cijk x delta k minus delta I minus delta j. And now you're going to have these things I wrote here, which now you can just determine. If you wish, you can put it into Mathematica. Do the series here and do the series here, and you can fish out the coefficients alpha and beta. Okay, that's an exercise you can do. Okay. Okay. So now that we have done that, now we can try to go back to the four-point function and try to compute it using the OPE. Okay. Now something that we will have to worry about is that. When you do the OPE and you have several operators, there might be several inequivalent choices of doing the OPE. I can collide 1 and 2, or I can collide 1 and 3. As long as the radius of convergence is proper, and we will worry about that, any two representations of the correlator shall have to give you the same answer. So by doing the OPE in two different ways, what you're doing is you're representing the answer in two different ways, but consistency tells you that it's the same answer. And the two different ways of doing the OPE are different functional dependencies of the CFT data. And that's where the constraints on the CFT data comes from. Essentially, from saying that the four-point function can be computed by the OPE in two different channels. I can either collide 1 with 2 or 1 with 3. Okay? Which is, by the way, this is what I did here. Is the difference between exchanging 1 and 3, essentially. Okay, so now let's go back to the four-point function. Can someone remind me not to erase that? I'll probably will, but anyway. But please remind me. So let's look at the four-point function of identical scalars. So now I have to write some perhaps scary-looking formulas, but I think conceptually, I think hopefully things are very clear what we're doing here. So let's look at phi x1, phi x2. Phi x3, phi x4. And we're going to do the OPE of 1 with 2, okay? And if you wish, 3 with 4. This is a choice of decomposing the four-point function using the OPE. And this will have a certain radius of convergence that we'll have to discuss, okay? And then what I'll do later is find a different way of computing this correlator by OPE that has different radius of convergence, but there will be a common domain of convergence to both series, and therefore the two quantities have to agree. Okay. So let's just now I have to write some pretty horrid formulas, but that's part of the job, I guess. Okay. So now I'm doing the OPE, but conceptually I think it's clear. So I'm going to do the OPE here and the OPE here. Okay. So I already told you what the OPE was. It's this. Essentially, okay, more importantly here, okay? And of course, here will be a sum, blah, blah, blah. And here there is an OK, right? Floating around at point at x, I guess. Okay, so let's do this. So one way to represent this is by these diagrams. This should not be confused with Feynman diagrams, but it's a way of representing the OPE channel. So you have operator one here, operator two here, operator three here. And what I've done is collide, do the OPE of one and two, and collide operator three and four, okay? Now, physically, the way you can think about it is I have operator one and two, and I have operators here propagating okay, okay? And I have to sum over all intermediate states. So what I have to do is sum over O and O prime. Now let's do the OPE here. It's gonna be C, phi, phi, O. I'm doing the special case in which I have the four-point function of identical operators. So that comes from this vertex. From the OPE of three and four, I get C, phi, phi, O prime. So I call this for some reason now. And now some function that's determined by that, as I argued here, there's some x dependence that's completely fixed by conformal symmetry. This comes from the OPE, the OPE of one and two. This comes from the OPE of three and four. Okay. But what am I left with here? I have one operator. I have an operator O from here, and I have an operator O prime from here. So what I'm left with is a two-point function, right? I've reduced this to a two-point function. Times OA at x2, OV at x4. Is it clear what I did here? I just did what I did before twice. Okay? But now I can use the fact that the two-point function in a conformal field theory is completely fixed. Now, in general, these guys are not going to be scalar. They can be tensors. But I told you that even the two-point functions of tensors are completely fixed using that inversion tensor I mentioned. Yeah, there's also some. There's an implicit sum over A and B. Yes.
Yes.
I'm not being very careful with the notation. Yes. Yeah. So if you wish, I could write here OA. I was trying to avoid indices, but it never works. At some point, I will quickly change to O because now, what is this? We know what this is, right? So this is delta AB, right? Times some tensor that's completely fixed by conformal symmetry. If this guy is a tensor, if this guy is not a Lorentz scalar, it's also fixed. Times x24 to the 2 delta O, okay? So this double sum collapses to a single sum, okay? So I can write this as a sum over O. I'm going to use now the language O of C phi phi O square. So I get the structure constants square, one from this vertex and one from this vertex, times the OPE part that's fixed by conformal symmetry. Four times IAB, which is a function of x24 divided by x24 to the 2 delta O. Okay? Yes?
Isn't the delta about the scale dimension, not about the actual level of the
space? Yeah, so that's why I was using this language of O and O prime. It just tells you that I can go to a basis in which the two-point function, I can diagonalize the basis of two-point functions so that I'm just block diagonalizing. So the two-point function is only non-trivial between an operator O and itself.
Okay. So okay, it's different for okay.
Yeah, so the notation, I don't know what the best notation is, to be honest, but physically it should be clear. So I have a collection of operators. I should have written O tilde, yeah. So you should think of them as different operators, right? And I'm saying that the two-point function is only non-zero if they're the same.
Yeah.
I think the confusion was the collapsing on the sum is not between, I mean, that delta function is on the scaling dimensions of the operators, right? It's not that the operators have to be the same.
But you can always, it's like in quantum mechanics, you can orthogonalize.
Choose the sum over,
yes.
You only have one operator per scaling dimension.
No, not one. There can be several ones, but you can go to you can diagonalize that metric. So imagine I have 75 operators of the same dimension.
Uh-huh.
I can diagonalize that metric.
But the thing is that there are certain different points.
No, but go to a basis. So I'm writing I'm using already the diagonal basis of where the two-point functions are diagonalized. Just a change of basis. Okay, and again, here we know everything in the sense that okay, these are we have a physical interpretation for everything. We have the three-point functions. These are some tensors that are well known, and these are these functions that are completely fixed by conformal symmetry that I discussed here. I didn't write them explicitly. I mean, these functions are complicated. I mean, like summing down these series is complicated, but conceptually we know them. Okay. Now I can write this in a way that. So now I want to compare this expansion to the most general parametrization of the four-point function that I wrote here, right? This is the most general parametrization of the four-point function I wrote here. So what I'm saying is that this equals that, right? I just computed the four-point function by doing DOP, so this has to equal that. So from that I extract. Okay, maybe do it here. Wow, I'm going so slow. I think Lucien was scared of me. That's good. Okay. Okay. So now let's compare the overall parametrization fixed by conformal symmetry with the one that you get from the OPE in this channel. We usually call this the S channel OPE with analogy with Mandelstam variables. Even though, again, this has nothing to do with Feynman diagrams. You should not confuse this with Feynman diagrams. So I can write. Okay, let me do it in one more step. So I can define this to be. Actually, I can skip the step. I can't. So I write this as x12 to the 2 delta phi, x34 to the delta phi, sum over O of C phi phi O square times some function. So ungodly mass LO of X. Okay? So I just told you that this guy is this object here. Okay? And if you wish, this guy is precisely this specific function of X. Okay? And I want to compare this with that. Okay. Now I have to tell you something about why did I write this function. So these functions, what did I tell you about these functions? These functions, if you wish, are completely known, even though they may be hard to compute. They're determined by an infinite power series. These functions were completely fixed by conformal symmetry, right? I'm convolving this power series that I was describing here. Okay. Now these functions have a name. They're called conformal blocks. So let me give you a physical intuition of what these things are. And the thing that's important about them is that they're, again, completely fixed by symmetry. Now, the way I want you to think about this problem is similar to the problem when you do a scattering in a central potential in quantum mechanics. Okay, what do you do there? You expand the amplitude into partial waves. There is a part that is not determined by symmetry, and then there is a part that has to do with the spherical harmonics, if you wish, right? These guys are the precise analog of the spherical harmonics for the conformal group. The amplitude has a piece that is a conformal, is like a partial wave expansion, but now instead of the spherical harmonics, is a conformal, is a partial wave expansion of the conformal algebra. Okay. And the amplitude decomposes into sum over partial waves. This sum over rho can be thought of as a sum over partial waves. Okay. And actually, this function, there's a direct analogy with spherical harmonics, are the harmonic functions of the conformal group, of more precisely the harmonic functions of SO 2 comma D. Okay. And okay, and in general, these are very complicated functions. Okay, and these are functions of the cross ratios U and V. Now, in certain dimensions, you can write down actually an analytic expression for this function, okay? And it's complicated. It's a certain product of hypergeometric functions, if you have ever come across those awful things, okay? So these are complicated but explicitly known functions, and generalize the whatever the Legendre polynomials or whatever those things are in for the spherical harmonic. So these are just glorified spherical harmonics. And what I've done is I've written the answer in terms of things that are purely kinematical, and the physical information is in here, and of course in the operator content here. So why does this function have two parameters? One is the dimension of the intermediate state here, but this is any primary operator, right? But the primary operator is labeled by the dimension, but also its spin. So this L should be thought of as the spin quantum number. I'm summing over all operators that have dimension delta and spin L. Okay. So what I've shown you is that by doing UP in this channel, I have reduced the four-point function to the product of two three-point functions. Okay. Now I'm going to do the same thing. Now I'm going to do exactly the same thing, but doing the OP in a different. Okay. So one thing I could say is the following: imagine now I go to the canonical frame in which this guy. Okay. So let me say. So what is the radius of convergence? And let me put the. It's easiest to discuss this by going fixing the 4 points at the canonical places. So let me fix at zero. At z, 0, 0, 0. So z is a coordinate in the complex plane. Remember that I said that the four-point function, one of the coordinates has to lie in a complex plane. I can move it around. I can put it into a complex plane. And then I have 1, 0, 0, 0. And here I have infinity, right? OK? So I'm just conformally mapping those 4 points, arbitrary 4 points, to these arbitrary 4 points, OK? Now, what is the radius of convergence of the OPE? I'm doing the OPE of operator 2 and to operator 1. So now I have a power series expansion in Z. What are the radius of convergence of the power series in Z? Well, until it reaches 1, which is the next operator in the list. Okay. So the S channel OPE converges for magnitude of Z smaller than 1. Okay. Good. This will be important in a second.
Can that be any?
No, it has to be a circle, and that to explain that that would require talking about the operator state correspondence. It has to be a circle.
Oh. Okay.
Because there is a relation with this convergence is of the operator product expansion is intimately related to the fact that in quantum mechanics, when you do a sum, the sum over when you decompose the identity operator over the sum over all eigenstates of over states, that series converges. The sum of, in CFTs, there's a deep relation between local operators and states. And the fact that the sum over operator converges is tied to the usual notion that sum over states in quantum mechanics converges. Even though you can think, why is it converged? I'm summing over an infinite number of states, like in the harmonic oscillator. But it does. Okay, so now I give you a representation of the four-point function in the S channel. Now let's do the OP in the T channel. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to collide which 1 with 3. Oh, am I doing this right? Sorry. Okay.
So it's 2 with 3?
Sorry?
It's 2 with 3?
Sorry? What did I say? I'm colliding 2 with 3 and 1 with 4. What did I say? Yeah, this means something different, but that's okay. Usually believe what I write, not what I say. Okay, so now before we do anything, what is this? So now I'm expanding Z around 1. Okay, so what is the rate of convergence of the S channel? So let me see if I can do this. So I have 0, right? I have the point 1. Okay. The S channel OPE has this radius of convergence. This is the, because I'm putting this guy here and it converges until the next point, which is at 1. Okay. Now in the T channel, I'm colliding 2 with 1, with 3, which is the location 1. Okay. Now where is the closest operator? It's 0. So the T channel OPE is centered around 1 because that's where I'm going, right? And it converges here. So it has a different radius of convergence, but what's important is that they have a common domain of convergence, which is this little wedge. So it is mathematically meaningful to ask. Analyticity essentially tells you that if I give you I give you the answer in the S channel, which converges here, and the channel converges here, they have to be the same, okay? But this is amazing because I'm essentially telling you two different ways of computing the function that is completely different. And in order for this to be true, it gives you like non-functional relations between the data of the CFT, which is C and delta, okay? So I'm not gonna draw the analog formula for this. It will be exactly the same, but with 2 and 3. I mean, by swapping some operators, okay? So now let's get to the non-trivial stuff. Okay, so what is the statement about, now what is the consistency condition? The consistency condition is that the OP in this domain, the answer computed from the S channel and the T channel have to be the same. In equations, this means that the following. Consistency of Abidanson implies the following equation, that the sum over O, C phi phi O squared, B delta phi, times a conformal block in the S channel, has to equal the answer in the T channel. And what did I say about the relation between the S and the T channel? I have to swap operators. That exchanges U and B. So this is going to be the same as U to the delta phi times G delta O L O of B U equals 0. So this is the constraint that common sense and OPE imposes on the four-point function. And the way you should think about this equation is that this is an equation in which everything is determined in terms of the structure constants, and these functions G depend on the dimension and the spin of the operators in the CFT, right? So, but this equation is extremely nonlinear. It's like a hypergeometric equation. So the way you should interpret this equation is that it's a constraint on the allowed values of C and the allowed values of delta phi and delta O in the CFT. This is the analog of what I was saying before. This is like the Jacobi identity. And the point I want to make about this is that actually the space of solutions of this equation, of this consistency equation, is extremely sparse. It's very hard to find a consistent set of data that will satisfy this equation. Okay. The idea, okay, and notice, okay, so and now in principle, if you're able to solve these equations, you have completely solved the theory. Because you, if you can solve these equations, you can determine C and deltas, and therefore everything is determined because that's what I said. Any endpoint functions can be reduced to a lower dimensional point function. Notice that you arrive at the solution of this problem without ever discussing Feynman diagrams, Lagrangians, blah, 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 okay? And in particular, let me just finish by saying that, for example, just by using this logic, you can compute the critical exponents of the 3D Ising model, which people computed like using Monte Carlo and all kinds of numerical things. This is something that you can extract essentially by analyzing this equation. Okay? And for example, you find to much more accuracy than you could ever get in Monte Carlo what the dimension of the energy operator, for example, is in the Ising model, up to seven or eight decimal points. I mean, I'm not going to bother with them. And the spin operator. So the upshot of today is that conformal symmetry plus consistency of the associativity of the operator product expansion, in some sense, can be used to completely solve the theory. This is like a theorist's dream that where just by pure thought, writing some equations, you can solve the theory completely. I think there are people outside, so I should probably stop. Yes. I can take him though. It's okay.